The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. I'm Paul Sweeney, alongside my co-host, Matt Miller.
Every business day, we bring you interviews from CEOs, market pros, and Bloomberg experts, along with essential market moving news.
Find the Bloomberg Markets Podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts and at Bloomberg.com/podcast. Just reading on the Bloomberg terminal right now, protests against China's strict COVID measures failed to materialize on Monday as the Chinese authorities deployed a heavy police presence in the capital and other major cities to deter a repeat of the weekend's demonstrations. When we saw the news over the weekend, I said we need to check in with Leland Miller. He's our go-to voice on all things China. He's the CEO of China Beige Book International. Leland, I'd love to get your perspective, given your experience in China. What did we really see over the weekend with some of these demonstrations? What are the takeaways?
Well, clearly frustration is boiling over. The Chinese people had to deal with a very draconian zero COVID policy for months and months and months and months and months and months now. And it has crushed economic activity. It's crushed travel. It's torn families apart. And so I think that there is a desire right now to send a message that this needs to end. And I think a lot of the protests were about a frustration with the leadership for not providing a roadmap out of this. Winter is COVID spreading season. Things were never going to be opened up over the winter, and they're still not going to be for the most part. But I think that the idea that people still don't have a date on the horizon, they don't have an idea of when their misery is going to end, I think that this caused things to really boil over. In addition, of course, to the fact that you've seen some very grisly events recently, like people trapped in their houses and fires consuming them. So this has really gotten to a point where people have had enough.
Now, I'm not sure. From what we understand here in the West, it's incredibly dangerous to protest in China, right? My idea is that if you go out there, you're literally risking your life. Is that really the case? Do people in China understand that? Because that raises really the bar for, what I'm willing to go out of my house and protest against.
Yeah, protests in China aren't uncommon, but what is very uncommon is to see protests surging in multiple cities at the same time about the same thing. This is not just about dissatisfaction with the local issue or a bank that people think might be insolvent. This is about a fundamental policy that the central government has that there's no tolerance for anymore. So protesting can happen, but this clearly was sending a signal that it could become something much bigger, which is why the authorities have moved in to try to stop it from boiling out of control in the short term.
Leland, does the Chinese government not understand, do the Chinese people not understand that they can't get to some level of herd immunity without massive vaccinations? That's what the rest of the world has learned. How is it spun within China?
Well, the way that Beijing has handled this over the past year or so, past 2 years or so, has been quite puzzling. For the first 2 years, 20 and 21, there were you know, there were tight restrictions on COVID, but nothing like what we've seen in 2022. There was plenty of time for the leadership to have started a vaccine rollout, to imported mRNA vaccines, to do a lot of the things that China needs in order to get out of this, and none of it was done. And of course, the belief is that Xi didn't want to be embarrassed by importing foreign vaccines. He wanted Chinese companies to be able to do it so they could claim victory domestically over the virus. But it's gotten to the point where, you know, we're here on the cusp of 2023. Most of the world has mostly moved on from COVID, and China is looking at what could probably going to be the worst COVID outbreaks that they've seen in the coming months. And so the policy response has been completely puzzling, and I think that's one of the reasons that people are so frustrated.
Is there any element of, you know, the party maintains control over the people by locking them down? I mean, it sounds so dramatic, and it's, but in a sense, I can't understand how that would actually work.
Yeah, you hear that a lot. It's hard to believe that this is about control, first and foremost. You have a situation where, you know, health risks aside, the economy needs to be open in order to thrive, in order to just be able to tread water. And what's happening right now is remarkable. You saw very, very few people as we entered 2022 believing that, you know, there wouldn't be a second half bounce, that Xi wouldn't relent at a certain point. And nothing of the sort has happened. So if you look at what's likely to happen in the coming months, the party has got to be responsive, at least look responsive to the people who are protesting right now. So there will be some sort of rhetorical relaxation. There are some policies they could target. They could talk about less, you know, splitting families apart, and they could talk about, you know, less stringent lockdowns or lockdowns for shorter amounts of time. But you're about to go into the winter months where COVID will spread out of control if there is no sort of control mechanism. And so there's really no good answer right now to the problem that the Chinese government has to solve. They cannot functionally open up the economy and not have massive COVID outbreaks, but they can't keep the population under control indefinitely under a draconian COVID zero. So you're likely to see them try to thread the needle, try to do the middle ground, and there's no guarantee that's not going to be a disaster as well.
Yeah, that is, it's tough stuff. I don't know how they're going to manage that. Leland Miller, thanks so much for taking the time today. We absolutely wanted to hear from you to get your latest thoughts on China here. Leland Miller, he's the CEO of the China Beige Book International. They have their own proprietary data sets and data sources over in China. You get some great, great information.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers, they're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Well, China seems to be one of the narratives of this Monday morning trading demonstrations over the weekend, causing some uneasiness as it relates to that economy. Apple saying they're going to be short maybe 6 million iPhones because of the disruptions in their plants over there in China. So we need to just kind of get a circle around this whole thing. We'll do that with Gina Martin Adams, Chief Equity Strategist with Bloomberg Intelligence, and Anurag Rana, he's a Senior Tech Analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence as well. Gina, let's start with you. How do you factor in, I don't know, China risk, if you will, to your market outlook?
Yeah, I think with respect to the U.S., China risk is largely centered on the multinational securities that do have exposure, either import exposure or export exposure to China. So clearly, any sort of persistent slowdown into 2023, a persistence of these lockdown measures and the zero COVID policy is a constant drag on this space in 2022 that will continue into 2023. For global equities, it really is a matter of the investment opportunity set just continually shrinking with the lack of kind of the investability of China. This recall for the last more than 15, nearly 20 years now, China was anticipated to be a very strong emerging market player, and that was certainly reflected in its growing share of the market cap of the global indices. Over the last year, even closer to 2 years now, that's really come under question, and it makes a pretty tremendous sea change in the investability of global markets, not having that big player as an area where you can put capital in the global markets has resulted in a flight to other areas in emerging markets, in particular India, where the valuation premium for Indian securities is off the charts. Investors have clearly tried to find ways to, you know, leverage emerging market growth outside of China.
What about producers? Let's bring in Anurag here. It's fascinating what the point Gina's making about valuations on the stocks, but you know, producers that make consumer goods like Apple still seem to have no problem, made in China, having made in China stamped on their products, and consumers still buy them like crazy, right? Is that changing at all, Anurag?
I don't think so. And only reason is there is no alternative at this point. I mean, what are you going to do? Buy a Nokia phone? So, I mean,
no, but they could produce in India, for example. Like investors are buying socks there instead, right?
No, that's a fair point. But the thing is, this is unlike socks. This supply chain took 20 years to build. You just can't get up and start building iPhones anywhere else. They have already started to do that, but just less than 5% of all iPhone assembly. And a large rationale for that is the supply chain for most electronic goods is centered in China.
So, Anurag, talk to us about, you know, what's Apple really doing day to day to try to mitigate this issue? What have you seen?
So we have already heard that they are assembling these phones outside China at this point, and I think it's going to take 4 or 5 years to make a meaningful dent to that. The second part is going to be, are they, you know, the parts and the other things that they need to actually assemble these products, are they going to start sourcing them outside? Now, for that, they really need to invest aggressively in areas such as Mexico or other low-cost regions where they can manufacture some of these parts. Without that, you know, the supply chain doesn't make any sense to, just do things in isolation, because at any given time, they are making millions of these units. It's not, you know, something that has only a few thousands that you produce.
All right. It's fascinating. So they basically can't, is what you're saying, move substantially as quickly as investors can. I just wonder if that means, Gina, does that mean that there's an opportunity here? I mean, do you buy the dip in that situation, knowing that it has to come back?
Buy the dip in China? Is that the question?
Yep.
I think for investors that are willing to take a tremendous amount of risk, your potential reward for taking on that degree of risk is fairly substantial, right? But at this point in time, it's relatively unpredictable. Most rational people are suspecting that the result of these protests over the weekend will be more further compression in economic activity, more clampdown as the authorities in China try to take on, you know, these protesters. So I think that the risk is tremendous right now. That said, the stocks are incredibly discounted. You are taking a risk that there is no opening coming in 2023. Nonetheless, there is very little expectation for growth baked into prices. So I think that your risk-reward works, right? You take on a lot of risk. You could get a tremendous amount of reward, but it is a lot of risk, admittedly.
All right, Gina, great stuff. Appreciate you checking in with us. Gina Martin Adams, Chief Equity Strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence. And Anurag Rana, he's a senior tech analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence as well. He follows Apple very closely. And again, investors today are just trying to parse what's going on in China. What does that mean for the outlook for global economic growth? What does it mean for some of the tech companies that still, like Apple, rely pretty heavily on the supply chain with lots of parts of that in mainland China? And you think about how this government is dealing with the zero COVID policy and what that means for economic activity. So again, that's kind of the narrative of what this market is trying to digest. Let's talk China. Let's talk kind of investing in emerging markets, because when we talk emerging markets, the MSCI, a big part of that is China. We can do that today with Kevin Carter. He's the CIO and founder of EMQQ Global. He joins us live in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio, so he gets an extra gold star today for being live, not phoning it in. Kevin, you've been doing business
in China.
Let's
start with the acronym. We always throw around these acronyms, and I feel like
boom,
we should.
Let it rip.
I guess emerging markets, and then it's tech stocks. Why EMQQ?
Well, that's exactly it. It's emerging markets technology, and specifically, it's emerging market consumer technology. It's the smartphone-enabled emerging market consumer that we're trying to tap into. So, yes, E is for emerging, M is for market, and QQ, as you know, is synonymous with tech investing. And also a sort of double entendre, because the Tencent original platform, the messaging was called QQ.
Yep, that's right, back in the day. So what
and it's an ETF, by the way.
It is an ETF.
Yeah.
And that's an exchange-traded fund.
That's correct.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I'm all over this stuff.
Just want to clear this up, because a lot of people driving around are like, what's EMQQ? You know?
Exactly.
And then they don't know there's an ETF. So if they like what Kevin has to say, they can go and buy it. If they think it's hogwash, they can sell it or whatever, you know?
Yep, well, the indexes are up this year, so good stuff. All right, talk to us about your take from China. I mean, you've been doing business there for a long time, investing in these companies and these industries. What's your takeaway?
Well, look, China is the second largest economy in the world, at least, and a big thing. And it's been the biggest part of the emerging markets indexes, the broad ones, over 30%. And it's an important place, but it's different than us. And it has its own challenges and its own ways of doing things. And I think it's hugely misunderstood. I think there's a lot of fears about China that are unfounded, things like delisting, the so-called government crackdown. So I think China's...
But wait, why are those unfounded? I have those fears, and I feel like they're founded quite well.
Well, I could go into...
Jack Ma, disappeared for a couple months.
Yes.
When the richest guy in the country just disappears for a few months, that's worrying.
Yes, well, I think Jack's doing fine. But look, what we do is invest in the internet and e-commerce companies in emerging markets, including China. And the reality is that while China might be an emerging market in a traditional sense, when it comes to the internet and e-commerce and smartphones, China is the most developed country on the planet by far. I mean, China is the Jetsons, and their e-commerce market dwarfs the rest of the world's, and it's actually four times bigger than the other 45 emerging markets combined. So China is important. It's an important part of the global consumer internet story, but it's the second wave, and it's the third wave that's coming beyond China that I think investors should be looking at.
I think a fair question is China even investable today?
Well, I think it certainly is. There are places like Russia that are definitely not investable currently in a traditional sense. But no, I think China is very much investable. But it's a volatile place for sure, and I think it always will be.
And, well, we just had Gina Martin Adams on from Bloomberg Intelligence, who said there's a lot of risk there, but the rewards are massive. The third wave that you speak of, is this also a China play, or are you talking about India? We were talking about during the commercial how important India could be.
Sure. So we have a second strategy, which is the emerging markets internet companies ex-China, which we call FMQQ. And the way to think about what's happening on the planet, and it's happened here, but it happened here so long ago, we forget that this is a wave that's happening. But you have sort of three mega trends. You have billions of new consumers in emerging markets. They're getting their first computer in form of a smartphone that costs $80, brand new, and is running on Android. And they're getting access to the internet for the first time. And because they don't have a computer, it's a traditional computer, they don't have a bank account, there's no Target stores, these people are leapfrogging traditional consumption. And so the first wave of consumer internet technology on the planet started in the U.S. around the year 2000, and we had a 15-year S-curve of growth. The second wave, the China wave, started about 2005 with Alibaba, Tencent, Baidu, which went public before Google. And that wave, that S-curve, you know, it's still growing, but the steepest part of that growth curve is behind us. And now you have India, Nigeria, Indonesia, Brazil, all of these other 5.5 billion people that are getting their first computer today. And again, it's not on their desk, it's in their pocket, and it costs $60, and they're getting the internet for the first time, and that story's just getting started.
And FMQQ, so if I look at the performance year to date, obviously everything's down, and EMQQ is down 36%, FMQQ is down 50%. Is there, you think, less risk in the frontier markets?
Well, I think there's a lot less risk in both versions because they're both down, as you mentioned, quite a bit. And in fact, the you know, the broader EMQQ is down at least at one point, you know, over 70% as of a couple of weeks ago. So this is a volatile place, but we're investing in companies. We're investing in what we think are going to be the most important growth businesses on the planet for the next couple decades. And those are the internet companies that are providing all the same things that the FANG stocks provide us, but they're providing those services to the 5.5 billion people in India, in Brazil, and the places I mentioned. And that is, if you're going to invest in emerging markets, that's where you want to invest.
And these are actively managed. I mean, this isn't, you're not tracking an index here.
No, these are rules-based indexes. So we own, you know, we own every publicly traded emerging markets internet company in our broader offering. And then the ex-China version, FMQQ, owns, you know, the 75 or so that are not Chinese.
What's number one on your to-do list looking at these companies in terms of due diligence? Is it quality of management? Is it soundness of business model? Is it balance sheet? How do you guys...
Rule of law overall?
Yes. Thank you.
Well, you know, the world's got a lot of risk, and emerging markets have a lot of risk. I mean, we've seen in Russia this year, I mean, war, and, you know, your stocks basically wiped out completely. So, you know, there's no free lunch in emerging markets, and there's volatility. In terms of the main part of the due diligence we do is just identifying these companies, because one of the problems, particularly in emerging markets, is that the database has so much power. And the biggest problem in the traditional indexes is that about a third of the companies are government-owned banks and oil companies, state-owned enterprises, which, in addition to having conflicts of interest and inefficiency, there's corruption that's rampant. And the second problem with the indexes is most of the internet companies aren't included. So if you look at Latin America, for example, Mercado Libre, the Amazon.com and PayPal of every country in Central and South America, it's not in the index. Nubank, the largest online bank in the world out of Brazil, backed by Berkshire Hathaway, NU on the New York Stock Exchange, not in the index. So the first thing is to make sure that we find all these companies, because the traditional approaches are leaving a big hole.
Wow, good stuff. Talk about risk and hopefully return. Kevin Carter, CIO and founder of EMQQ Global, talking about emerging markets here, the risk-reward. Certainly front of mind for a lot of investors today as we kind of process what's going on in China. As we got another data point with Apple Computer and their production issues. So front of mind for emerging market investors.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Looking at WTI crude oil, getting back lots of the losses it had earlier today. We had reached a low of today of $73.60 per barrel. We're now at $75.75 a barrel, off about 0.6%.
By the way, I just texted you a photo.
You did?
And I texted Eric also. Okay. Check it out. I was in Newark, Ohio this weekend.
Wow.
I drove by a gas station called Sheetz, yep, which you may know if you're a trucker or if you spend a lot of time on highways. They had $1.99 a gallon unleaded.
That is amazing. What's
and I
going
guess
on
it's
there?
I guess it was some kind of marketing thing, but my nephew at the Thanksgiving, you know, gathering when the whole extended family was there.
Sure.
He's just got his driver's license. So he went around the house collecting people's keys and driving out to fill up at the Sheetz for us.
Good stuff. Adding value there for in the Miller household. All right. We've got global energy here. Let's talk about it. Let's roundtable it. We can do that with Fernando Valle. He covers this stuff for Bloomberg Intelligence. And Mike McGlone, he's our commodity strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence. I have no idea where these people are, but they're not in studio, I can tell you that. Fernando, talk to me about, I guess, you know, your view of crude here. Is it all hinging upon demand out of China?
In the short term, Paul, I think that's correct. It's China, and then it is the Western world as well, because if you remember, we talked about how Europe is curtailing their demand in order to meet their needs for winter. And then inflation is impacting consumers on the U.S., globally, really, but in the U.S. and emerging markets. And that will impact short-term demand. I think when we look towards the second half of 2023 and beyond, then supply becomes a bigger question than demand. But in the short term, we see a lot of those pressures continuing. The consumer is squeezed, and in China, between COVID zero and their own economic wall growth, presents a big risk for WTI demand.
Mike, what's your take on what we see happening in China? Apparently, the protests have been quelled today, but I still think it's pretty monumental that people are willing to risk lives and livelihood and come out to protest.
I think that's part of the micro from China. The macro is China, incremental demand from China in terms of all commodities have been declining for a long time. Their imports of crude oil really peaked a few years ago. Now, Fernando can speak to that more. And everybody, a lot of the bulls have been spoken to the hopium. But I've been pointing out this has been happening for quite a while. Our Chinese strategists out of Asia said the property crisis still has another 25% more to go. So to me, that major incremental source of demand in the world has been bad for a while. And you look at the yen, they dropped the triple R rate last week. The first time they cut the triple R rate was almost 10 years ago. So they've been trying to support their economy for quite a while. And I like to point out what's really happened in the last 10 years is OPEC's largest customer, used to be U.S., is now a competitor. So to me, that's part of the reason we're going to continue to go lower in crude oil. Now, I think now is pretty good price. But the key thing is it got too expensive, that pendulum swung too expensive. Now it's a question of how cheap will it get, and it's almost guaranteed to get some form of cheapness as the world tilts towards recession, as our economist model for the U.S. recession is very high for next year. So to me, this is just part of that pendulum swinging back, and one thing that crude oil has been doing is just following copper. Copper's down about 20% on the year.
But Mike, doesn't OPEC come in with more production cuts as the price falls?
Responsive. OPEC is notorious for cutting prices when prices drop a lot. Their job is to keep prices up. So the last big example was 2008. So OPEC will cut. Remember, OPEC used to be 40% of total supply around 10 years ago. Now they're less than 30%. They're less and less important. The most significant thing that's pressured crude oil prices since 2006, which is the first time we traded the current price on the screen, has been U.S. supply and Canada supply exceeding demand. And the U.S. demand actually peaked right around that time. So this is a major paradigm shift. And this is what I see is crude oil is just a massive swinging pendulum. It got too expensive going back down. And OPEC is becoming less and less significant. And yes, they will cut because they pointed out the Fed's tightening and they see the demand destruction. That's the biggest factor right now. And I think Fernando even led to it. Demand destruction right now is just getting started. And the question I ask, what stops this process? It's not going to be Fed or central bank easing.
So, Fernando, you know, we're talking about some of the U.S. shale operators. What are they telling you about production, capacity, all that kind of stuff?
Well, they are struggling with inflation themselves, and they're struggling to grow at the rates from prior years. And so in the short term, there's a little bit of growth still left. But we really think that U.S. shale is not going to reach the levels expected a few years back of 15, 16 million barrels a day for total U.S. production. We really think we're nearing our overall peak in supply. And that's why I agree with Mike in the short term that demand is a much more relevant issue. And then the pendulum swings back towards the upside once we don't have enough supply. And Mike alluded to OPEC not being as important. We also don't know that they have the spare capacity to overcome that weakness in U.S. shale. And then we really believe that the inventory picture in U.S. shale is a lot dimmer than was projected, even in 2021. A lot of the high-quality acreage has been drilled. And if you look at the productivity per well in all four large U.S. Shale basins, they're weaker in 2022 than it was in 2019.
So just got about 30 seconds here, Fernando. Do we start to see real drops in prices at the pump as well? I know that there's a big mechanism that needs to, you know, be played out, but, and I've lost all hope for diesel, but for regular unleaded, does it continue to come down towards the sheets $1.99 a gallon level?
Yeah, I believe that's true. Maybe less so in the northeast of the U.S. just because of logistical issues. But when you look into the mid-continent Gulf Coast, you should see lower prices over for the remainder of the year, with Brent and WTI selling off, and then even the crack spreads themselves are a little bit weaker. So you should see some relief, holiday relief.
All right, good stuff.
For other people, Paul, not for us.
Not for us, not in New Jersey. Fernando Valle, senior analyst of Bloomberg Intelligence, covering all the energy space, and Mike McGlone, he's our commodity strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence, breaking down what's going on in global energy. Today is Cyber Monday. You're going to click away, Matt, and make some purchases here today?
I've already done it.
You've done it?
Yeah.
Look at you.
Because I don't know how much it really matters, Cyber Monday. I started to see huge deals pop up like on Thursday and Friday already.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's bring in Jen Bartascia. She's senior equity research analyst. She covers all the retail stuff for Bloomberg Intelligence. Jen, talk to us about kind of what we know so far during this, you know, Black Friday coming into Cyber Monday.
How was it?
Well, you know, it was probably a little bit better than people expected, but it was nothing spectacular. And that really shouldn't be a surprise to anyone because we've got consumers who are a little bit more conservative, and we have retailers who have spread out those deals, as Matt was saying, over a really long period of time.
Yeah, I mean, they already started to announce them before Black Friday, and they seem to last a while. Are retailers having a problem with inventory across the board, or is it just specific stores that got stuck?
It was really some specific stores that were having inventory issues, and specific categories even within certain stores. And so, you know, apparel has been an issue. I think it's going to continue to be an issue through this holiday season. You know, we had our entire retail team out on Black Friday, combing through stores, hitting the malls. And, you know, we saw there were bags, people were buying things, but it wasn't in bulk. And apparel was one of those areas where people were buying very specific things in apparel. It wasn't across the board. So, you know, I think it's kind of a mixed, you know, result. But the good news was that people were out and they were looking for deals.
And if I were to go shopping, and that's a big if, Jen, will I find stuff on the shelves?
You will. The inventory seems to be pretty right-sized. You know, there are certain hot items that are out of stock. You know, we do an annual toy survey, for example, in Bloomberg Intelligence, and there are some hot toys of the season that are out of stock now across Walmart, Target, Amazon, but it's really on very select items at this point. We're hoping that this means that, you know, it'll be a solid season and that they won't be left with too much inventory as we head into January and February, though.
What's the Tickle Me Elmo of, or the Cabbage Patch Kid of the year?
Well, you know, so far this year, it's been a lot of video games are out of stock. So people are definitely loving their gaming type.
How can video games be out of stock? You just buy a digital copy online.
Well, a lot of them still come on the little discs that you pop into those older consoles. And so, you know, those have been uniformly popular across all the retailers.
You know why?
Why?
Because kids that get them want to be able to resell them later. So that's why the existence of those discs, or that explains the existence, continued existence of those discs in the Game Shop brick and mortar stores.
Coming
that
from
actually
a gamer.
Makes sense.
Yeah, they're like trading card versions, but they retain value, whereas, you know, the digital code, you can't really pass it on.
Hey, Jen, I know you also in your coverage cover Beyond Meat. That stock got downgraded by Barclays today after the stock's down like 70 or 80%, so thanks a lot, Barclays. But what's the deal with that whole faux meat thing? Is that a flash in the pan? Is this a real sector within the food industry? How do you think about it now?
Well, I still think of this as there's a strong long-term case to be said for alternative proteins. But the current environment and looking out over the next year to 2 years is going to be a really tough environment for those players. And really, there's just a bunch of headwinds that they're facing. One is the consumer. People are trading down. Alternative proteins are more expensive still than conventional proteins. So if people are watching their budgets, they're pulling back from those alt meat products. And then you have a lot of challenges because they're growth companies, and so they have not yet mastered, you know, how to build a bigger business and do things the right way with regards to manufacturing or lining up their innovation queue so that they do things in a smooth and uninterrupted manner. So there are growing pains that are happening simultaneously with external pressures as well coming from the consumer.
And Jen, I know you cover the supermarkets as well, and one of the areas that consumers have seen inflation probably the most profound is the supermarket. Do prices ever go back down, or I don't know, are we just going to pay these higher levels forever?
No, they actually do come back down. I will say, when I look across the broad scope of retail, grocery stores are some of the fastest to bring prices back down. And so we have seen inflation starting to moderate. I think you'll start to see some prices come down in different categories in the store slowly as we get into the middle of next year. But they will come down. Now then, you know, if there are additional pressures, they could always go back up again. But they tend to, unlike other categories, they don't necessarily reset that bottom. They can go back to some closer to historical norms. The problem we have with food is that we were in years of deflation for a long time, and people got very comfortable with very low food prices, especially here in the United States. And so that makes the inflation we've had feel even more, even more challenging than it might otherwise
painful.
Have felt.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point, Jen. You know, I was reading a few notes about not just Beyond Meat, but also Tyson Foods, and analysts were saying, look, it's the whole protein area.
Space.
Just because of the cost. Investors are looking for other places, although my initial thought was you need protein anyway to survive. You can't look for something else.
It's true, but people also aren't thinking about, you know, for beef, it's a multi-year cycle to bring a cow to market, right? And you have other factors, like there's drought, where it makes it more expensive to feed those cattle, which means that ranchers have fewer head. And when they have fewer head and they go through that, 18-month cycle, there are fewer cows, which then drives up cost and you know,
I don't know.
Supply,
aren't they making the same amount of chickens as they always make? I don't know. Jen Bartashis, great stuff. She breaks it down for us. Senior equity research analyst. She covers everything's on the retail side, consumer, Beyond Meat. We can pretty much ask her about anything, and she's got some good analysis to back it up. So we appreciate getting her time.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Markets Podcast. You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Matt Miller. I'm on Twitter at MattMiller1973.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. I'm on Twitter at PT Sweeney. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide at Bloomberg Radio.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, let's face it, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. There's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.